You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has, quote, hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. This is our second episode on the Arabian Nights. We're doing nights 19 through 34, and we have five stories to tell you today. And with me is Dr. Michael Farmer, and he has some things to say about that, I think.
How's it going, Josh? Yeah, I apologize to our listeners for our absence last month, but we just could not get it together for a recording. So here we are now.
Yeah, we're happy to be here. So you've got some news in your life, Michael?
Yeah, I wanted to plug a couple of other projects I'm doing for anybody who might be interested. I, as of 3 days before this would have posted, I've been doing a podcast for the Front Porch Republic, a magazine I've written for some time. It won't be catchable through your podcast apps. You'll have to go to the Front Porch Republic website to listen to it, or you'll have to download the Mixcloud app, because it's basically a mixtape I'll make every week on a particular theme, and I'll talk about some songs and play some songs. The first week is on middle age, so it's a bunch of songs about what it's like to be a middle-aged person. Josh, a favorite of ours, is on there, Luxury. I end with a luxury song. Can you guess which one? The luxury song about middle age? They have a bunch of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, don't put me on the spot, Michael. I don't know which one about middle age you would
have
picked.
It's The Gates of Paradise, okay. The last song on Shrek.
Okay, there you go. That's a good one. That's a good one to pick.
So, yeah, I hope our listeners will tune into that. And then I was also a guest. I guess this is the second time I've done this show. I think I might be like a semi-permanent co-host on this now. There's a show called Propaniacs, which is a watch-through of the show King of the Hill. And my friend who goes by the name Melton McMainerberry hosts that show, and he asked me to come on. So I talked about one of the darkest episodes of television ever made, the episode Pretty Pretty Dresses. Do you ever watch that show, Josh?
No, I know you're a huge fan, but it's not a show that I've seen it, but I couldn't speak intelligibly about it.
I would not start with Pretty Pretty Dresses. It's an episode where it's a Christmas episode where a guy goes crazy because his wife left him, and he ends up thinking he is her. So he starts wearing a dress and talking like her. It's a comedy, family comedy. Anyway, so that one you actually can get through Apple Music or Spotify or wherever. Propaniacs. It's a fun show. Melton prepares just rabidly for those. The amount of work he puts into that show and his other show, Nashville Anthems, is unbelievable and puts what we do here to shame. I mean, we do read.
We do. We do the reading. Yes. Well,
you know, I don't know if our listeners have figured this out. We don't have an outline or anything like that. I don't have any idea what Josh wants to talk about other than the specific stories. Josh doesn't have any idea what I want to talk about other than the specific stories.
I think it adds a vibrancy to our show.
It makes it lower key, more relaxed.
That's
more
right.
Conversational.
It is. It's very conversational. Yeah. Michael and I met through a radio station that is no longer in existence, called WTXR. And Michael had a radio program. What was your radio program called, Michael?
The Satisfactory Rate with Michael Farmer. That's right. And you know what? I almost used that name. I almost just kept with that name because I liked it so much. But then I realized that if I call it that, everybody will expect me to rate the songs, which is not what I'm doing. If I name the show, it's the Symposium of Popular Songs. That's the
Symposium of Popular. That's
which is a Disney reference. There's a late 50s Disney short called A Symposium on Popular Songs, where Ludwig von Drake teaches you all about jazz music and rock music and stuff. But yeah, we did meet at a radio station. It was fun. You were a much better DJ than I was.
Well, I don't know if that's true, but I do know that you continue to have a music show, so that's awesome that you have a mixtape show. That's exciting to me. So
You had a bunch of shows, right? So you did was it Thursday morning? Did you have Thursday or Friday morning?
It's been too long, Michael, but I did have a morning show, yes.
We are talking like more than 20 years ago now.
Yes, but I did have a morning show.
I think I had Thursdays. I think you had Fridays and I had Thursdays.
Well, I did it for a couple semesters at least. So, because I was Trendy Nate. I was host with Trendy Nate or co-host with Trendy Nate for a little while. And then I was co-host with Sarah Atkinson. So we may have changed days at certain points too. So
right. There was the one year where it was all male-female pairs for the morning shows. And I think you were Fridays with Sarah, and I was Thursdays with Mary.
That sounds right. Yeah, that
sounds right. I don't remember. I think Garth, our friend Garth, who was also in our band, he was Tuesdays, but I can't remember his co-host name. I don't know. This can't be interesting to anybody. But you also did were you in the Pit, the heavy metal show?
Yeah, so we did the Pit, and then the Pit kind of transformed into... So my friend had another show called Spandemonium, and then we kind of combined the Pit and Spandemonium into Super Spam and Friends was the final iteration.
Right.
And the most enjoyable iteration, I think. We had a lot of fun on that show. So
and that
I
show
think
was
I was,
super
I was at my
chaotic,
peak
right?
DJing. Yes. But it was super chaotic, but it was as nostalgia. It's fun.
So yeah.
It's fun to think back to it.
It was maybe the one actual college experience at the Christian college we went to is the college radio station. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I know what you mean, but I mean, we were in a band and we played shows on campus. So, I mean, that's pretty college experience.
That's pretty college.
Yeah.
But I was, you're right. I don't know how much of this I'm going to cut because I don't know how interesting it is to our listeners. And it certainly has nothing at all to do with the 1001 Nights. But I heard the story the other day about Willie Nelson's bass player, B. Spears, always carried a gun, sometimes more than one. And the reason is that sometimes promoters would refuse to pay Willie and his band in the early days, and B. Spears would pull the gun and threaten them. And I was telling my wife about it, and she said, people just refuse to pay them? And I said, yeah, it happens all the time. We played a show. I don't know if you remember this, Josh. We played a show, and they were supposed to pay us, and they told us right before we were supposed to go on that they weren't going to pay us.
Yeah.
But our bass player did not pull a gun on them.
Yeah, and that's why we still didn't get paid.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Come on, Max.
I feel like Max, of the four of us, was probably the one most likely to pull a gun.
Absolutely.
All right, shall we talk about the 1001 Nights?
We should. Yeah. So you mentioned Disney earlier. In the former iteration of the show, we watched some terrible movies. And I suppose reading this is better than that, because if you say, hey, I watched Home on the Range, people just might feel bad for you. Whereas if you say, I read 1001 Arabian Nights, people will be like, oh, you're educated. But I'm not sure which one's worse.
Really? I liked quite a few of these.
Did you?
I think the ending with the five stories from the barber was pretty rough. But I enjoyed quite a bit of this.
Yeah, there is. So I think it's, I mean, it's apples and oranges, obviously. There's a lot that I enjoyed. And it's just that it seems like in every story, there's something that's also just kind of like gross. It's like
they are much more sexually explicit than I expected them to be.
Yeah. And so it kind of ruins it for me. And I know I have this like reputation of being a prude or whatever, and maybe it's just coming out, but like, I don't know. Like, it's like, even this first story that we're going to read here, or that we're going to talk about, like, there is no real justice whatsoever in it. You know, yeah. So I don't know. There's that aspect too. It's just like, well, is there anything from this? Is it just pure entertainment, darkness? I don't know. So, I mean, I don't know how it compares to King of the Hill's darkness, but you know what I mean?
They feel darker than King of the Hill.
Yeah. They just feel kind of dark to me, you know, even the humorous ones, like we have a couple funny ones today. But even the humor ones just feel kind of dark to me. So, I don't know.
No, not, I mean, there was an awful lot of darkness in the Grimms too, and those weren't always they didn't always come out shiny on the other side either.
It's true, and I was talking to somebody about this because I was trying to kind of figure this out, you know, and like why the and I don't know if it's just it may be a little bit just cultural bias, you know, like I'm culturally closer to the Grimms than I am to the Arabian Nights. But I also feel like in the Grimms, there was, even when things were really dark, which they were in a few of the, you know, like I always think about that one where the boy gets killed and
Juniper tree, right?
Yeah, the juniper tree, which is a great story actually in some ways, but terrible in others, right? Like the boy gets eaten by his father. Like that's like really disgusting and disturbing, you know, but I don't know. And again, maybe this is the cultural bias coming through. I feel like maybe there's like a symbolism or something in there, even if I don't fully get it. Whereas with the Arabian Nights, it's like way beyond me. I'm like, I don't know what the point of this, you know, is other than, but we'll talk about it today as we get into it.
I think so also that was just my prelude. Are much longer. The longest of the Grimm stories was 15 pages, and that would be a medium to short story in 1001 Nights. So you're just with them for a very long time. One of the stories we read today, it's hard to track how long a given story is because there's stories inside them.
Yes.
But one of the second level stories we read for today was almost 70 pages long. And we're coming up episode after next on a first level story that is 300 pages long. So, I mean, that's the length of a novel. There's lots of novels that are shorter than that. So I think that probably has something to do with it as well. The Grimms, however dark it is, you know it's going to be over in 5 pages. This, you're really sticking in this world for a long time. And because you come and go from story to story, I think it makes it feel even deeper than it otherwise would.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Yeah. So anyway, I don't say that to say I'm not enjoying doing the podcast or anything like that, because I am. I'm still enjoying it. It's just there's something where it's a little more work than than watching a movie or whatever it was. So
I will say I read the Quran this summer. That was one of my reading projects, and it did not help me understand the Arabian Nights at all. I thought it might give me some insight. These stories are set in a Muslim environment. I do not think they are Islamic stories. I don't think they're Islamic stories, even in as much as the Grimm stories are Christian stories. Mm. Now, you know, I read the Quran once. I'm not a scholar of it. I've read the Bible more times than that. I'm much more familiar with that culture, so I'm probably missing things. But these feel less theological to me than Grimm's, even now having a little bit more background in Muslim theology. You know, again, not an expert. Read the Quran once, but
sure.
I did read it.
And I wonder how many of these stories predate the Quran, potentially. And,
sure, yeah. Know,
and then have gotten kind of turned into Muslim, like culturally Muslim stories, as opposed to Islamic stories or whatever. So I don't know. All things we don't know, which I feel like every week I just have to repeat. Like, we're trespassers in the land here.
but the Arabian Nights are not what I expected them to be. That is 100% true. They're much more violent and they're way more sexual than I expected them to be. I'm going to gloss over some of that stuff when I summarize some of the stories today. We didn't talk about one of the super hypersexual ones a couple months ago, the Porter and the Three Ladies of Baghdad.
Yes, I was.
Hopefully you're not just reading these to your kids, Josh.
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not reading these to my kids. I think that's part of it, is I can recommend the Grimm, like when we were doing Grimm's and people are like, oh, what's your podcast? I'd be like, oh yeah, we're reading the Grimm's and you should read them too. Like there's something valuable in them. And with these, I'm like, I don't know if you should read them or not. Maybe you should, but it's, you know, they're a little, they're a little more on shaky ground.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Grimm's are for adults. We've talked about that they're not just for children, but these are much more obviously for adults. It is difficult to imagine somebody reading the story of Harun al-Rashid and the Fisherman's Chest to their kid to put them to sleep at night.
Absolutely.
Maybe that person exists, but I don't know that person, I don't think.
Neither do I. All right, take it away. Let's hear the story of Harun al-Rashid and the Fisherman's Chest.
So this is the frame story for the first half of the stories we're reading today. So this is the first level story. There's a bunch of them embedded in them. I'm going to skip over the stuff that's embedded in them except the one that we're going to talk about. One day, the caliph Harun al-Rashid decided that he wanted to eliminate injustice in his caliphate, and so he decided to walk through Baghdad and ask the people about the governors who are oppressing them and should be removed. And I think I mentioned this last time, al-Rashid is a real caliph. He's responsible for the Islamic Golden Age that takes place in Baghdad. He's considered one of the great caliphs in Islamic history. And you see that here. This is a guy who's very concerned with justice in his caliphates. He and his vizier, Jafar, are walking through the streets when they come across a fisherman, and the fisherman is complaining about the miserable poverty he has to live in. It's one of those places where a character in the 1001 Nights recites a poem to express his feelings. So al-Rashid felt compassion for him, and he told him to go back to the water, and that whatever the next thing he pulled up out of the water was, they would pay 100 dinars for it. And as it happened, he pulled up this giant chest, and the caliph pays him, and he walks off, and they open up the chest, and lo and behold, there is the body of a dismembered body of a woman inside this chest. And al-Rashid is terrifically moved by this, and he starts crying, and he tells Jafar, if you don't figure out who commits this murder, I'm going to have you and your whole family executed instead of the person who committed the murder. Which, to me, seems like kind of an overreaction. Jafar doesn't know what to do. He asked for this 3-day grace period, and during that time, he apparently doesn't do anything. I was expecting something to happen during that grace period, but nothing happens. He asked for it, and then he just sits around worrying about what is he going to do when it's over.
Yeah, it's not a murder mystery.
So al-Rashid sets up this public execution, and just as Jafar is about to be hanged, this young man comes forward and confesses that he's the one who murdered the girl. And then, as they're about to hang that young man, an old man comes forward, and he confesses that he's the one who murdered the girl. Al-Rashid says, well, let's just hang them both. What's the problem? But Jafar says, no, you can't do that. That would be unjust to whoever didn't actually commit the murder. You don't want to be an unjust caliph. So you need to figure out who actually did it. Finally, the caliph discovers that it was indeed the young man who committed the murder. And he explains what happened. That's technically a separate story. Is it called The Young Man and the Three Apples?
Something like that, yes.
The long and the short of it is a slave used an apple to trick the young man into thinking that his wife was cheating on him and that he killed her in a fit of rage. So that's how this woman died. And al-Rashid says he needs to execute the slave because the slave is the one who's responsible for the woman's death. And al-Rashid tells Jafar that he'd better find him the slave or else once again, he's going to execute Jafar instead. It's a very different vizier named Jafar from the one we all know and love from the Aladdin movie.
Yes, very different.
Well, as it turns out, the slave belongs to Jafar himself. It's his slave. And Jafar has mixed emotions about this. He's glad he found who did it, but also he feels some shame that he has this connection to the slave. And so Jafar tells the caliph the story, and the caliph tells him it's the most remarkable story he's ever heard. And so Jafar tells him, actually, I have a more remarkable story, but I'm not going to tell it to you unless you refuse to execute the slave. And so the caliph says, I won't execute the slave if the story is as good as you say it is. At which point, Jafar tells the story of Nur al-Din and Shams al-Din, which is one we're going to talk about in just a minute. But the Caliph loves that story and agrees to set the guilty slave free because it was such a good story. And that is the story of Harun al-Rashid and the Fisherman's Chest.
Yeah. See, this is what I mean by there's no real sense of justice in this story, right? Like, everybody gets off scot-free in the end. Because it's entertaining, like the whole misunderstanding and everything is just, it's just like funny, but this girl still died.
Yeah. And, like, and her killer's not going to come to justice.
Yeah. And it actually says, kill the slave. What the young man did is excusable. So it's totally excusable for him to, because he believes it, I know we skipped over this part of the story, but because he believes that his wife cheated on him with a slave, it's completely excusable for him to murder her, cut her into pieces,
and just throw her body in the in
put
the
her river. Throw her body into a river. It's like, yeah. Okay.
It does seem like there's a kind of coded critique of al-Rashid in this, doesn't there? This is a guy who's supposedly super concerned with justice, but every time we actually see him attempt to enact justice, he behaves wildly unjustly.
Right. And that unlocked the story for me a little bit, just you saying that, Michael, because what I didn't, I think you did say it last month, and I'd already forgotten that Harun al-Rashid was a real historical person. So thank you for reminding me of that. And thank you for reminding me that he's supposed to be the just guy, because I think that does shed some light on this story and why it still feels so unjust. So that makes me feel a little bit better about it.
And then it also might, it
it's
might
still very
be
dark
to remember that we called this the first level story. It's actually a second level story. And the only first level story in the entire Arabian Nights is Scheherazade attempting to keep this unjust king from killing her.
That's true. Yeah. That's the highest level frame story, right?
So whenever I think we called it Night Zero last month, but whenever she tells a story about one of these leaders who's behaving justly or unjustly, you always have to remember she's telling it to someone who is systematically deflowering and murdering women because his wife cheated on him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It makes me want to skip ahead to the end and find out if he learns any lessons from this or if he just kills her after 1,001 nights.
Let's see. This volume is almost 1,000 pages and there's two more.
Yeah, I don't know that we want to get through all of them. I'm just saying, like, I am kind of curious, you know, spoiler alert, how it ends. I'll look it up on Wikipedia later, I guess.
Yeah, I actually don't know. I assume he lets her off. But I could be wrong. I mean, this is certainly a collection of stories that is willing to let evil people get away with evil things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
We just keep coming back to the importance of storytelling. How much it matters in this society. That you are actually willing to let a guilty person go free if the story they can tell you or that somebody can tell you on their behalf is interesting enough.
Right, because juxtapose that, Michael. Like, this is what he says when they pull up the box. He says, "Are people to be murdered, thrown into the river during my reign, so that I am responsible on the day of judgment?" So there's an idea that because he's the king or the sheikh or whatever, you know, the sultan, whatever it is, like
caliph.
That the caliph, that he is responsible for these people and that he's held to a higher level of judgment on the judgment day. But even so, a story can sway him, you know? And so that is really something remarkable.
When he says, "I'm to be held responsible for this," the person he holds responsible for it is a person with less power than him. If Jafar doesn't figure out who did this, which is an impossible thing to figure out, even in 3 days, an impossible thing to figure out. The only reason they figure it out is because people confess, which happens again in one of the later stories we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Jafar's whole family is going to be executed. How is that just?
Yeah.
How is Harun al-Rashid actually seeking justice here? It's a critique of him as much as it's a puff piece about him. It's very difficult to determine this document's position toward Harun al-Rashid.
Yeah, definitely. Without some knowledge I don't have, it is 100% impossible to tell, because it's like, well, I don't know. Because I don't know, like, also, I mean, justice, I mean, maybe there's a different view of justice, you know, like maybe somehow there is a balancing of scales or something, you know, but it seems to be that you're saying like the author or the original teller or the hearers would know, like, no, killing all of Jafar's family is also unjust, because actually it mentions it in the story too, that right. All the people who come to the thing are like, well, why is he being executed? So, yeah, it seems like the author's idea of justice is at least somewhat in line with what you and I would call justice.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think we're supposed to think that al-Rashid is behaving reasonably here, any more than we're supposed to believe that the king who has married Scheherazade is behaving reasonably. Yeah. I mean, al-Rashid has in his favor that he is a better person than Scheherazade's king, but not mm-hmm. much better.
Yeah.
Which is, again, interesting, because al-Rashid is, from my understanding, almost universally loved. Muslims love him, Christians love him, Jews love him. He was very tolerant of other religions during his reign. He is the one who opened Jerusalem up again for pilgrimages for medieval Christians. He is the one who sent the white elephant to Charlemagne, thus naming your Christmas party gift exchange.
Yes. Wow.
So, like, this is a wildly popular caliph, and it's interesting to me that they would that's the guy who they would attach this ridiculous behavior to.
Yeah. That is very interesting. Well, something I did not expect was some reality TV tropes to show up in the middle of our 1001 nights. We got Undercover Boss and Storage Wars.
It is Storage Wars. Fortunately, nobody ever found a dismembered body on Storage Wars. Wait, they didn't, right?
I've never actually seen the show.
I haven't either. You got to figure that in all the storage units in this country, there's got to be a dismembered body in one of them, right?
I hope not, but...
You should make a movie of this, Josh, but set it in the modern day and make it Storage Wars. And it's like the president of the network is concerned with the justice of the situation because of what happened to him on Judgment Day. And he tells the head of programming that if he doesn't find out who killed this woman, he's fired.
Yeah. Makes sense. And all of his family. He's yeah. fired, and all your family
and
who works.
Also, everybody else is.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill all your cousins. Isn't it his cousins?
Yeah. It is his cousins.
Well, shall we talk about the story that he tells to have his slave freed? This remarkably interesting story that's so good that al-Rashid is willing to not execute a slave who tricks somebody into killing his wife.
That's right. If you are ever in danger of being murdered or wanting to get somebody off over like from execution, just pause and ask if you can tell them a really good story first and try this one.
This is Nur al-Din and Shams al-Din. This story is incredibly long. I am going to give only the high points, but understand I am leaving out a huge amount of material. It would probably take 30 minutes to tell this whole story. The vizier of Egypt had two sons, Shams al-Din and Nur al-Din. Nur al-Din, excuse me. Nur al-Din is another historical figure. When their father died, the two of them both inherited his position, so they both become vizier of Egypt, and they happily shared the power. But one day, Shams al-Din told his brother that he wanted them to get married on the same day and have children at the same time, and he said that he would have a daughter and that Nur al-Din would have a son and that the daughter and the son would get married. Now remember, neither of them has even a prospective spouse at this point. Nobody's pregnant. They don't have any children. This is entirely hypothetical. Nur al-Din likes the idea, but he says that when this happens, Shams al-Din shouldn't be asking him for a dowry because men are much better than women. And this makes Shams al-Din mad enough that the relationship breaks apart and Nur al-Din leaves Cairo forever to wander the world. Because of this hypothetical marriage between the hypothetical children they have with their hypothetical spouses.
Yeah, I found this part very funny.
Right, it's supposed to be funny, right? It has to be.
It has to be. It's really, really funny.
So Nur al-Din ends up in Basra, Iraq, and he falls in with the vizier there. And it turns out that this vizier was his uncle. He is the brother of the father of the vizier of Egypt, the father who had been the vizier of Egypt. This is his brother. And that the father and the uncle had agreed years earlier that only one of the father's sons could marry the vizier of Basra's daughter. So all of this is like a providential puzzle piece being put into place where this is who he was supposed to marry the whole time, but he didn't know that when he ended up in Basra. Meanwhile, Shams al-Din was sad that he'd fought with his brother, and he married a woman whom he met in Cairo. And unbeknownst to him, this happened on the same day that his brother married his cousin. So far, this bizarre plan that they worked out is actually happening. They're getting married on the same day. And Shams al-Din had a daughter, and Nur al-Din had a son. And then the vizier of Basra died, and Nur al-Din inherited the position, and his son Hassan, who's really the main character of the story, he grew to adulthood, and he was intelligent and handsome. He was as handsome as the full moon. That's the expression for handsomeness and beauty that that comes up over and over again in these stories. As handsome as the full moon. So Nur al-Din begins preparing for his death around the time his son Hassan turns 20. And he writes a letter to his brother Shams al-Din, and he gives it to his son. And then he gives his son some advice. He tells him, never trust anyone, never oppress anyone, never drink wine, never gossip, and always protect your wealth. And then he dies. And a new vizier comes into power, and Hassan has to leave Basra. So Hassan is going to have to wander the world. Meanwhile, Shams al-Din's daughter was just as beautiful as Hassan was. The Sultan of Egypt noticed this and asked if he could marry her. And Shams al-Din says, sir, I'm sorry, I would love for you to marry my daughter, but I can't allow it because I want her to marry Nur al-Din's son, who I don't know exists. This infuriated the Sultan, and the Sultan spitefully decides to force the girl to marry a hunchback. This is not the hunchback from the story The Hunchback, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. This is another hunchback who, I don't know which one of them has it worse.
Far as we know, I mean,
yeah. Oh, you know, that's true. This is like the Arabian Nights extended universe.
Yeah, there you go.
So Hassan fell asleep on his father's grave, crying about how he had lost his position. And while he slept, some spirits carried him to Egypt so that they could judge whether he or the girl was more beautiful. And when he woke up, one of the spirits told him, there's gold in your pocket, and that you should throw that gold if any of your cousin's servants show up. Hassan is very confused because he has no idea who this woman even is. He doesn't know it's his cousin. But he ends up at her wedding reception to the hunchback. And at the wedding reception, all the guests notice that Hassan and this girl are clearly very attracted to each other, and everyone makes fun of the poor hunchback. The spirits end up tricking the hunchback into spending the entire evening on the toilet, upside down on the toilet, I believe, and Hassan and his cousin spent the night together doing what came natural. It's not super explicit, but it's more explicit than I'm going to say on here. The plan was for these spirits to come take Hassan back to Basra in the morning, but they weren't able to do that because they got attacked by some angels. The Muslim angelology is very complex, and it doesn't really matter for the story, so I'm not going to go into it. But they end up having to drop him off, not in Basra, not in Cairo, but halfway in between in the city of Damascus. And the residents of Damascus were very suspicious of him because he was only wearing half of his clothes. Nevertheless, a cook took him in and adopted him and taught him how to be a cook. Meanwhile, the girl wakes up and she finds that her lover's not there anymore, and she assumes he's just gone to the bathroom. So she goes to her father, Shams al-Din, and she tries to convince him that she didn't sleep with the hunchback last night, she slept with this other person. And she proved it by pointing to the clothes that the spirits had left behind when they took Hassan off somewhere else. And Shams al-Din realizes from the clothes that the young man is his brother's son. And as it happens, the girl had been impregnated by this encounter, and she gave birth to a son, whom she named Ajib. But the other children in Cairo make fun of Ajib relentlessly because he doesn't have a father. And finally, the mother tells him the truth about who his father was. So we've got Nur al-Din is dead, but Shams al-Din is still alive. His daughter is not married to Hassan. His daughter was impregnated by Hassan and has the son, Ajib. That's where we are. So Shams al-Din takes his daughter and his grandson to try to find Hassan. And when they get to Damascus, they don't know he's in Damascus. They're going to Basra. But they stop in Damascus because it's halfway. And when they get there, they happen to go into the shop where Hassan had been working for the last 12 years. And Hassan is there, and he and this kid immediately feel a connection between them. And Najib casually mentions he's looking for his father, and this makes Hassan think about the family that he had lost, and he starts crying. And Ajib and his family end up leaving the shop, and Hassan follows them. But then Ajib sees him following them, gets freaked out, as you would be, and he throws a rock at him. So finally, Shams al-Din and company arrive at the palace in Basra, and Shams al-Din introduces himself to Nur al-Din's widow, and she agreed to come with them back to Cairo. On the way back, they stop again in Damascus. Ajib, by this time, feels really bad at having thrown that rock at Hassan, and so they go back to the shop, and Hassan cooks him this dish of sugared pomegranate seeds. Ajib tells his mother and grandfather that he'd gone to this shop, and they're really mad at him because it's below his station to go to a diner like this. He's the grandson of the vizier. He shouldn't be hanging out at seedy restaurants like this. Seedy, nice pun. No pun intended.
Pomegranate seedy.
So Ajib told him the pomegranate dish he'd eaten was better than his grandmother's. And when the grandmother, who is Hassan's mother, tastes it, she knows exactly who this is because it is her dish that has been, you know, fancied up by the 12 years he's worked for this cook. So Shams al-Din decides to trick Hassan and Ajib into a reconciliation for some reason. Instead of just telling them who they are and allowing them to reconcile, he decides to trick them into reconciling. So he has Hassan arrested and tells him he's going to execute him because there wasn't enough pepper in the pomegranates. Shams al-Din tells his daughter to make the bridal chamber look exactly like the one where she and Hassan had slept together all those years earlier. And then he leads Hassan into the room where he reunites with the vizier's daughter. He takes his rightful place in the Egyptian royal family. The end. That is the story of Shams al-Din and Nur al-Din. Although it does seem like it's really the story of Hassan and Shams al-Din.
Yes. Well told, Michael. Nice job.
I left so much stuff out. It is such a meandering story. It really is like some of those Grimms where it starts off in a completely different place than it ends up.
Right. This one I mostly liked. There's a few things in it that just were terrible, but like you caught the gist of it there. And it is fun the way that, you know, I guess in this case, like it says in the story early on, as God Almighty had willed it in order that what he had decreed might be fulfilled among his creatures. So there's this definite like providential hand moving and working all through their lives to bring them all to this happy ending.
Which so is maybe why you have that echo of the Joseph story at the end of it. Right. Shams al-Din tricking Hassan into thinking he's being executed in order to demonstrate the providence of this whole thing is very similar to Joseph tricking his brothers into thinking he's going to execute them.
Foster
her. And Joseph's okay. The one who says what you meant for evil, God meant for, except nobody means any of this for evil. It just happens, but God clearly means it all for good.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Michael. Because that part of the story was so weird.
It's bizarre.
That I was, it almost ruins the story, you know.
Like, why do you have to trick them? They're both of them would like to reconcile with the other person. Nobody's right on the other side of this.
Yeah. Well, his argument is, I had to make sure you were really the guy because I'd never seen you. But it's like, well, couldn't his daughter have identified him, or couldn't his, like, he has the guy's mom with him, you know? Like,
right.
Couldn't, like, both of their testimonies together have identified him? Yeah, I guess neither of them have seen him in 12 years, so maybe not, you know. And I can totally see, you know, just based on living in these stories, how someone might come along and, you know, fake that they are Hassan in order to, you know, gain the position and gain the wife. Like I see his protection. It's just that his plan is so bizarre and weird that it just almost ruins the story for me. Almost.
Yeah, he's gonna trick Hassan into thinking that he's having a psychotic break or something, that time has folded over on itself and he's stepped back into this bridal chamber from 12 years earlier when he already had no idea where he was or how he got there, right? Like, he woke up in Cairo after falling asleep on his father's grave in Basra, and the Ifrits, I think they are. I think they're like semi-demons, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, there's a genie and an Ifrit, I think, that are arguing over who's the more beautiful. Is it Hassam or Shams al-Din's daughter, which I forget what her name is.
I forget her name, too. It does give her name a couple of times, but
I mean, she's barely in the story, in fairness.
Right. It really is. This is really Hassan's story. It's about him ending up being the fulfillment of this ridiculous dream that his uncle and his father had all those years earlier. 40 years earlier by this point, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Because I mean,
I mean, their grandson now is 12 years old, right? So,
when he was, I think he was 20 when he left Basra. So maybe it's only 35 years earlier.
Yeah, but still.
And the idea that you would have this plan that somehow comes to fruition, like, why would you even want it to? Why is it so important that you get married on the same day and have children on the same day and that they get married? I mean, I guess you're maintaining the alliance.
Yeah.
It's funny you're expecting, or I was expecting, when the two of them become co-vizier that they're going to fight over the power, but they don't fight over the power. It's not about the power at all. It's about the respect that is due to this person's hypothetical daughter.
Right. Which is really... So the story starts really funny. And maybe the ending pieces are supposed to be really funny too, and it's just not my sense of humor, you know? Like, maybe
So do you think the idea is Al-Rashid just thought this story was so funny, like it was such a good joke, that he decided not to execute the slave?
I don't know. I don't know if that makes it better or worse. I think there's something more to the story than a joke, I think.
Yeah, the providence underlying it, I think, is the kind of theological or philosophical thrust of the piece.
Yeah, and I guess maybe in some ways that ties back to I'm making this up off the top of my head, but like to the justice piece, like, can you really be held responsible for something when it's all just providence? And the way that first story is, like, it's so ridiculous with the, you know, the slave stealing the apple and then telling the story. And then, you know, like, we didn't talk about all of that cause it's all in the inner story, but like, maybe there's a sense of mirroring there. It's like, if providence is in charge, like, all these things are going to come about and there's nothing like we can really do about it.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. The idea that that's what this story is doing. That's why it convinces Al-Rashid that, you know, these things happen and Allah has his plan. And maybe focusing too much on perfect justice is a mistake because we don't know. We don't know the millions of ways that our actions are affecting the world.
Yeah. I still don't know if that lets murderers off the hook, but
unrepentant murderers, right? Like the slave in that story, it's not like he feels bad about what he did.
Right. Well, the slave didn't even murder anybody. I mean, all the slave did was lie that he had gotten this apple from a mistress when really he'd stole it from a kid, you know? And so, yeah.
In that way, to go back to that story, in a certain sense, if I don't know what the law in Baghdad in I can't remember what years Al-Rashid lived, whatever, in Al-Rashid's time, if there was a law that said if your wife sleeps with a slave, you're allowed to kill her.
Yeah.
Who is guilty? If the slave tells that lie not intending for the woman to be killed, and the man kills her from his perspective legally, who is responsible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whoever made the law.
right. Well, who would have made the law though, Josh? You know what I mean?
Right.
Al-Rashid is responsible.
Yeah.
Or his predecessors or whatever. That story's deeper than I thought it was. Gosh.
That's why our conversational nature is so fun, because sometimes we come to something like without expecting it whatsoever.
I think you might have really sold me on Al-Rashid and the Fisherman's Chest. Actually, I liked that one to begin with. I that was one I picked. This was the one both of us picked.
Yeah. I think
what did you like about this one?
I do find it very, I found it very entertaining. There's a lot of poetry in this book, which I love. Like I think it would be so cool to live in a culture where people are just quoting poetry to each other all the time. And so I think it's really cool, but I'm not always moved by all the poems in it, but I really liked in our edition, which it's the Penguin Classics translated by Malcolm C. Lyons. It's page 131, if anyone's paying attention. But I really like the poem on this page. It's short. I'll just read it. "Go and you will replace the one you leave behind. Work hard, for in this lies life's pleasure. The stay at home is humble, arriving at no goal except distress. So leave your land and go. I see that water left to stand goes bad. If it flows, it is sweet, but if not, it's not. Were the full moon not to wane, the watcher would not always follow it. Lions that do not leave their lair will find no prey. Arrows not shot from bows can strike no target. Gold dust, when in the mine, is worth no more than earth, and aloes wood in its own land is merely used for fires. When taken from the mine, gold is a precious object of demand, while elsewhere in the world it is outranked by aloes wood." That particular poem, I really liked it. I was like, oh, that's like, I don't know, it made sense to me in some way, you know, more than some of the other poems in here. So there's that aspect. And then, I don't know, there was just the story overall. I the twists and turns of how are they going to end up back together, because you know they're going to, in some way, you know, is fun too. So
yeah, I like this one too. You know, it occurs to me, I'm going to say this, I don't know if it's true or not, so I'm going to say it and let's work out whether it's true. I think there's more characterization in these stories than in the Grimms. Like, I think the people are rounder as characters than the Grimms are.
Yeah, I think that's true, because I think in a lot of the Grimm stories, I'm trying to think back to all the ones we told, you know, but yeah, in the Grimm stories, they were very, like this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. Right.
You get a little bit more of their internal world in these stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of that is the poetry that they recite at each other. There's no poetry reciting at each other in Grimm's, I don't think.
I guess there's a couple of songs.
There's a couple songs. That's right. Yes. Back to the Juniper Tree. My mother killed me. My father ate me. My sister took care of me and buried me under the juniper tree or whatever.
That old song.
Yeah. So yeah, there are some songs, but you're right. Like, there is a little more, like, I don't know. I think there's a little more feeling in these, as far as like, you can kind of imagine in some sense, you know, like how Hassan feels when he's like in this position of power and then all of a sudden he loses everything. Like, the guy comes and tells him like, hey, the Sultan's trying to kill you. You gotta run for your life, you know? And you know, kind of the feeling of, oh, I see this person and I'm like strangely attracted to them, but I don't know, like just those sorts of human emotions, you know, not that you necessarily experience those things, but just the human emotion of it, I feel like is stronger in these than maybe in some of the Grimm stories.
Right. And I think part of that is just that they stretch out for so longer. They have much more space to develop stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true too.
And even a shaggy dog story like this one, the movements feel less abrupt than they do in the Grimms, just because it is so much longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything like this one, I wouldn't even necessarily characterize as a shaggy dog. Like, it is, it's generational story for sure. Like, you get three generations in it and it takes a long time for them to come together, you know? But I think it all connects. I mean, the only thing that makes it like so crazy about spread out over all these different cities and stuff and how they can't find each other is because of the, magical acts, you know, where the genie and the ifrit show up, and if, had they not shown up, then we wouldn't have a story, you know, but right. Because they show up, you get this weird thing where he's got 12 years in a, as an unknown in the city, you know, working for this cook or whatever. So,
which all of that feels like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm.
You have the undercover prince, the person who's, you know, nobody knows he's royalty. He doesn't even really know he's royalty, and he's living among the people. You have the unrecognized act of recognition. Spiritually, you can definitely see the connections between this and the Grimm stories, some of them at least that we read.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's what I liked about it, was it just felt a little more fairy tale-ish. And in the end, everybody...
Which feels like a mean joke.
Right. Well, and there is a mean joke in this one, too. And both this one and the next one, like, it's at the expense of a hunchback in both of them. And so, like, in both of that, like, it leaves a foul taste, for sure. You know? Like, the treatment of the treatment of the hunchback in the story we just told, and in the story I'm about to tell, is terrible. Right? Like, there's no way, like, there's not strong enough language for how terrible it is, really, you know. But even the treatment of Shams al-Din's daughter is pretty bad in that one also, you know, like, she's being forced to marry him because,
well, women are worth less than men. That's what it says at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And that's why he shouldn't expect a dowry.
Right. And the story bears it out, I guess. So I don't know. Anyway, you want to hear
but again, here's where I do think you have to keep story zero in mind. All of this is being told to the most powerful person in the land by a woman.
Yeah. By a very remarkable woman, as we talked about last time, that she has
stories memorized, or is just making them up as she goes along. Yeah. I don't know which one is more impressive.
Yeah, both would be pretty impressive. So yeah, you're right. I don't know which one would be more.
I mean, it'd be great if she had needed 10 fewer nights and the barber didn't have to tell the story of his brothers.
Yes, it's true. All right, this is the tailor, the hunchback, the Jew, the inspector, and the Christian, I think is the way that it's introduced in the story. So this one takes place in China, I think, or the tailor's from China. China is involved somehow. And this tailor and his wife, they've been at a party and they've been having a great time. And on their way home from the party, they see this drunk hunchback, and he is he's a jester of sort. Actually, later in the story, we're going to find out he is the court jester, and he is just able to make everyone happy, no matter how sad you are. And so they see him, and they're excited to see him because and they're already cheerful leaving the party. So they invite him to come home with them, and in the as they come home, they're eating a fish, and as part of the revelry, I guess, that they're in, the wife of the tailor takes a handful of fish and stuffs it into the hunchback's mouth and says, "You have to swallow without chewing." And the hunchback does so, but the wife didn't know. She unknowingly put a fish bone into his mouth, and this ends the hunchback's life. So the tailor and his wife are obviously in a panic. They didn't mean to kill this hunchback. And so she says, we have to do something immediately. Put a sheet over him. We'll pretend he's our sick child, and we will take him to a doctor. And so this is late at night. It's dark, but they're walking through the streets, and she's talking to this corpse as though it's her child and saying, you know, how is the fever getting better or whatever? And so that everyone... no one suspects anything. And they get to the house of a Jew, and this Jew is the doctor. And the slave girl comes down the stairs, and they say, "Please tell your master that we have a sick child that needs cared for." And they give her some money. And she goes up the stairs to go get her master. And when she goes up, the husband or the tailor secretly follows her, leaves the body at the top of the stairs, and they take off. They take out of there. Well, the Jew hears from the slave that there's people needing his help outside the door, and he sees the money. He's excited, and so he jumps up, and he runs out, and as soon as he runs out, of course, in the dark, he trips over this body, and it falls all the way down the stairs. And so the Jew comes down to the bottom of the stairs, and he sees the body there, and he thinks, "I tripped over this poor, sick person and knocked them down the stairs and killed them. And I, you know, again, there's the panic of, I didn't intend to kill this person, but I did. And so he brings them back up into his wife, and his wife, it's always the wives with the ideas in these stories. the wife says, hey, our Muslim neighbor, he works for the king, and he's always bringing home extra fat and stuff and leaving it in his yard. And the rats and the dogs and everything are always coming and taking care of all the fat every night. So if we just throw this body over there, then the dogs and the rats will take care of it and it'll be fine. And so they do that. They throw him over into the Muslim's yard. Well, the Muslim is just getting home as this happens. And he comes in, and he sees a person in his yard, and he says, so you're the thief that's been stealing all my stuff. I thought it was the dogs and the rats. And he grabs a hammer and he hits him, not intending to kill him, I don't think, but just to scare him or frighten him away. But he realizes that with the strike of the hammer that he's dead. And so he says, oh, I didn't intend to kill this guy. What do I do? And so he drags him off to the market, and he's just going to leave him in the market for somebody to find. Well, a Christian comes along, and this Christian is drunk, but he's trying to get home in time for matins. And he has to use the restroom. And so he's just going there kind of in the dark of the marketplace, and he sees this body looming over him. And someone earlier in the night had stolen his turban. And so he thinks, in his drunken state, that this guy is also trying to steal his new turban. And so he jumps on him, and he's punching him in the neck and screaming and choking him. And the whoever it is, that, you know, the night guard on duty at the marketplace, hears the commotion and runs over and sees him and says, you're a Christian and you've killed a Muslim, and this is terrible. And the Christian's like, I didn't intend to kill him, but, you know, that sobers him up real quick. And so he's taken to the judge. And the judge says, well, you're a Christian and you killed this Muslim, so we're going to have to hang you. And so they're getting ready to hang him. They actually have the rope around his neck. And the Muslim comes up and says, I already killed a Muslim. I can't have a Christian on my a Christian's blood on my hands as well. I'm actually the one who killed the hunchback. This Christian is innocent, and he tells his part of the story. And so they take the noose off of him and they put it onto the Muslim. And then they're about to, you know, pull the lever or whatever they do to, you know, let the trap door go, and the Jew runs up, and the Jew says, I already killed a Muslim. I can't have two Muslims on my hands. I'm the one who killed this guy, tripped over him in the night and knocked him all the way down the stairs. And so they take the noose off his neck and they put it onto the Jew's neck. And then just as they're about to pull it again, the tailor runs up, and the tailor says, I can't have a Jew's blood on my hand. I'm actually the one who killed him. He tells the story of the thing. Well, meanwhile, just as he's telling this story, the king is missing his hunchback, because he's like the court jester. And the king's like, where's my hunchback? And his people tell him, oh, he was killed in the night. And actually the trial is going on right now. And it's really hilarious, because all these different people keep running up and saying that they're the one who actually killed him. And so the king calls all of them over to find out the story. And the king thinks it's remarkable. And they say, well, if we can tell you a more remarkable story, will you not kill us? And so that's the frame story. And then all of them then tell their story. But what turns out at the end, so I'll just finish this story up, is in the end, the tailor tells a story about a barber, and they call the barber in, and the barber comes in and says, this hunchback isn't actually dead. And he pulls out the bone from his throat, and he's alive. And it's such an amazing story. It should be written down in gold letters.
This just is a joke. Like, this is a very, very funny, farcical story. And yes. And I think if they filmed it, there would be a lot of opportunity for really high level physical comedy.
Yeah.
Dark physical comedy, stuff you would feel really bad about laughing at, because this poor disabled man is being, I mean, it's Weekend at Bernie's, basically, right?
Yeah, that's basically what's going on.
Very funny. And then you have the long setup, setup after setup after setup after setup, and then it tears down in the opposite order. So you have that chiastic structure where it's A, B, C, D, D, C, D, C, B, A, where they kind of build up the structure of the story and then dismantle it piece by piece.
Yeah.
Oh, well, actually, the Christian's not responsible. The inspector is. The inspector's not responsible. The doctor is. The doctor's not responsible. The tailor is. You have the multiple races involved: Christian, Muslim, Jew, Chinese man.
Yeah.
They're all like it. It really has the structure and the content of a joke.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people would tell a joke like this today.
No.
It seems like the sort of thing that would get people on Twitter to make you lose your job.
I guess. Yeah, but it was. Yeah, you're right. You feel a little bad laughing at it, but it's also, it's written very well. It's very funny. And so.
And it has a happy ending. I mean,
and it has a happy ending. Everybody's alive in the end.
It's not just that the guilt is undone. The act itself is undone.
Right.
The hunchback comes back to life miraculously at the hands of this. We won't talk about the barber, but the barber tells a series of stories about his brothers, and it's the most boring thing you've ever heard.
It's very painful.
He's an incredibly annoying person, but he's the one who brings the hunchback back to life.
That's right.
Given the things they've done to the hunchback after he was supposedly dead, it seems like he would probably be dead even if he hadn't choked to death on the fishbone. But what do I?
Well, he's only been punched and strangled and hit with a hammer. So
thrown down a flight of stairs.
Thrown down a flight of stairs. That's right.
Lowered down into somebody's house from a neighboring building. hit with a hammer. Yeah. My favorite is the Christian who is like falling down drunk and suddenly realizes he has to get to morning prayer.
Yeah.
Which is I don't think even would be a requirement for a medieval Christian to go to morning prayer.
I have no idea, but
it's also a weird version of China where it seems to be a Muslim majority city in China.
Yeah, I did. I wasn't quite sure about that. Although in Western China, it is, you know, majority Muslim, I think, in Western China. So
that was true. I didn't know that.
I think the Chinese government doesn't want you to know that. So it's not surprising that you don't know it.
Is that where the ethnic group that they're...
Yeah, the Uyghurs are in that area. And yeah, I think they are more ethnically Muslim. And if that makes sense, I don't know if those words make sense together, but you know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah. And so they're not the whatever. We don't need to get into Chinese politics, but they're not the ruling ethnicity of China. So
one thing that strikes me about this story is that concept eucatastrophe, which is so important to fairy tales. It's Tolkien's term. Everything looks like it's going to be a sad ending, and inexplicably it becomes a happy ending. Uh-huh. That happens like 8 times in this story. Over and over again, you look like you're going to have a bad ending for whoever you're talking about, and then a happy ending gets pulled out of it. The tailor and his wife look like they're going to get in trouble, but they pass it off to the doctor. The doctor looks like he's going to get in trouble, but he passes it off to the inspector. And then when the crime is discovered, it moves backwards. The Christian, it looks like he's going to be executed for something we know he didn't do, even if he doesn't know he didn't do it. And his salvation comes out of nowhere. And that happens again and again and again until the final eucatastrophe where the barber miraculously pull the most annoying person in the Arabian Nights miraculously pulls the fishbone out of the hunchback's throat, and it's a happy ending for everybody.
Yeah, except for the executioner. He is really upset.
It's true. The executioner is so angry he doesn't get to execute anybody.
So yeah. It's a fun story. It is, like you said, it's basically a joke. There's not really much to say about it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the joke.
Well, I think we only have one left. Is that right?
We have two, but yeah, we don't. Yeah. If we don't get them all, I think that's fine. Cause we are going kind of long here. So you should tell the young merchant story at least, and then we'll see where we are and if we tell the tailor story or not.
Sounds good. So the young merchant story is actually a sub story of the story that the Christian tells the king, but we don't need to worry. We're not going to consider it as part of that story. So a young man came from a rich family in Baghdad, but he had heard about how impressive Egypt was. So after his father died, he took his inheritance and he took a large collection of fabrics to trade, and he came to Cairo. But he had enough trouble making enough money with those fabrics, and so he was advised to sell them on credit. So he's going to collect the money twice a week. He's going to owe money to other people, but ultimately he's going to make twice as much as he invested. So it's a little bit less secure, but it's going to end with him having more money than he would otherwise have. And this scheme allows him to live a life of leisure. He eats mutton and candy, and he drinks wine every morning for breakfast. One day, he's talking with a fellow merchant at the market, and this beautiful woman comes up, and the young merchant falls in love with her as soon as she speaks to him. She asks for a piece of silk, and she offers to pay for it later, but the other merchant said he had to have the money that day because it was the day he owed the money to the young merchant, so he wouldn't let her have it on credit. So the young merchant calls the woman back, and he pays for the silk himself, and he tells her, "You can either pay me back later, or you can just keep it with my compliments." She blesses him, and she says, "May God give you a good reward, endowing you with my wealth and making you my husband." And he falls deeply in love with her. It gets to the point where he's not able to eat or sleep because he's so fixated on her. One of many acts of erotic obsession in the Arabian Nights. Men often fall so in love with women that they can't think of anything else. Finally, the woman comes back to the market, and she repays him more than she owes him. And he makes it clear to her that he wants to have a romantic relationship with her, and she walks away embarrassed. But then her servant comes back to the market and tells the guy to come speak to her privately. And when he does, the woman tells him, "I am hopelessly in love with you too. Why don't we have an assignation after Friday prayers? So you go to the mosque and pray, and then you come over to my house to do some less holy activity." He never actually goes to prayers. Did you notice that? Like anytime other people are at prayers, he's preparing for this relationship. Anyway, he shows up and he finds that the woman lives in outrageous luxury. So they make out for a while, and then she feeds him a fantastic meal, and they eat until they can't eat anymore, and then they tell each other their life stories, and then they make out some more, and then they eat another enormous meal, and then finally they go to the bedroom to do what comes natural. This continues night after night for some time. Every day he buys a bunch of materials for another luxurious meal with her, and he sends them to her. And then one morning he wakes up and discovers he spent all his money on this woman. And so he goes out into the city, and he happens to bump up against a soldier, and he looks down and finds almost against his will his hand is on the soldier's purse, and so he takes it. But the soldier notices and has him arrested, and the young merchant knows he can't get away with lying about it, so he just tells the truth and says that he's stolen the purse, and they cut his hand off. And then the soldier gives him the purse afterwards, because he feels that the young man is too beautiful to be a thief, so he gives him the purse that he'd stolen. Now, when he went back to the woman, he was too embarrassed to let her see his hand, because she would know that, you know, the person who gets his hand cut off, he gets it cut off because he's a thief. So he makes some excuses, but eventually he drinks enough wine that he falls asleep, and she sees that his hand's been cut off, and she sees the soldier's purse, and she knows what's happened. And so she's filled with grief, and when he woke up, she pledged her everlasting love to him. The two of them get married, and she dies of illness just 2 months later, and he inherits her entire fortune. And that's why he eats with his left hand instead of his right hand, which is, you know, a plot point in the Christian story. But that's the story of the young merchant.
Yeah. Kind of. I don't know quite what to say about this one. Is there a moral here? Like, should they have just gotten married in the beginning and then
Why they didn't, if they were so in love with each other?
Yeah.
Because it seemed, and we're told from the beginning when she makes that blessing of him, "May you become my husband and inherit my wealth," he says both of those things happened. So yeah. there's no tension that it's not going to happen. It's interesting to me that he skips, mass, that he skips Friday prayers for this.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of mass.
Yeah.
He skips Friday prayers, and they go and eat this unbelievably decadent meal. It's described in not incredible detail, but in some detail. It's an enormous amount of food. And then they eat another enormous meal, and then they have sex. And I just think that's interesting that he's giving himself over to all of these different physical pleasures at the same time. The whole thing starts, like, one of the first things we learn about his life in Cairo is that he's drinking wine for breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah, he's definitely deep in the worldly, deep into the worldly pleasures. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what that means. I mean,
but he doesn't become pious at the end of the story.
I know either. That's what I mean. Like, it's a really weird happy ending, you want to call it a happy ending, because like they never get out of the honeymoon phase, I guess, and he gets all the wealth. Like, you know.
Yeah. Perfect.
I mean, that's what it feels like. Like, kind of like creepy, creepy man. Perfect.
It's Anna Nicole Smith. There's a timely cultural reference. But also there's this weird tension where he doesn't show her his hand because she's afraid that she is going to think so poorly of him that she dumps him. Right. That's why he doesn't want her to see that his hand's been cut off.
Right.
And when she does see it, she feels bad for him.
Yeah.
Like, well, she's much better than he deserves, it seems to me.
Yeah, so he just seems to be presenting some sort of false self to her and the whole time. And she seems to not be worried about it. So.
And yeah, in which case you kind of get an influx of grace in his life, right? He learns that the image he's trying to put forth is not worth putting forth, and this woman loved him for who he was. Too bad he had to lose his hand over it.
Yeah, that's right. And lose her. But that doesn't seem as important. But you're right. As far as, like, I mean, in the story, I'm not saying, like, you know.
No, you're right. Like, he is curiously unbroken up about her death.
Yeah. But, and you said it's not like he becomes pious, but he does become very generous. Which, I mean, maybe.
That's true.
Maybe he's.
And that is piety.
Yeah. Unless he's just trying to live lavishly again with his generosity, and he's just going to end up destitute again. Who knows? But that's not the impression the story gives.
Well, do you want to do the Taylor story, or do you feel like we've talked enough about this story set?
Okay, I'll try and go fast. Actually, this is a story that, like, in summary form, it's not going to make as much sense as the story itself. And so I won't try and tell it. I'll just summarize it. But if you like this kind of story, then maybe you'll want to read this one. It's the Taylor story, and it's on, you know, it's nights 29 through 34. But it's not really that whole time, because the frame story is just the beginning. But anyway, there's a party that's happening, and this... The tailor is at it, and in walks this man, and he is crippled. Like, his leg is lame, and he sees sitting at the table at this party a barber, and he immediately says, "I'm not joining you for this party. Goodbye." And all the guests are in shock about this, and they say, "Well, tell us your story. Why won't you stay?" And he says, "This man basically ruined my life. He's the reason I have a limp, and I've vowed never to be near him again in my life. And see you later." And somehow they persuade him to tell the story. And once you hear the story, I feel like what he actually should have done is said, "No, I'm not even telling you the story. Goodbye." But basically, this man falls in love with the judge's daughter, and he sees her in a window, and falls madly in love with her, as men are ought to do in these stories, or want to do in these stories. And so he sees her through the window, falls madly in love with her, and but he knows that he can't have her because she's the judge's daughter. So he has a servant, an old lady servant, who realizes what's going on and connives to arrange a meeting during the prayers. So everyone else will be at prayers and they can get together. Seems like, you know, a great plan. So he's got a couple hours before prayers, and the old lady says to him, "Why don't you get a haircut before you go see this lady?" And he says, "Yeah, that's a good idea." So he calls in a barber, and as Michael has alluded to, this is the most annoying person that you could possibly meet. He keeps claiming to be things he's not. Like, he says that he's not interested and he's not curious. He's not pestering. He's not, he's the silent one. He has six brothers, and he talks about how all of his brothers have all is are the babbler and the jabbler and the howler. And he's the silent one, but he is clearly not. And he's just very annoying. And, main protagonist character, I don't know if you even know his name, but he just, he's trying to bear it, but he cannot bear it. And at one point he tears his clothes because this guy is just so annoying. And he's like, can you just cut my hair? But he has to first like set up this astrolab to make sure that it's the auspicious time for cutting the hair. And he has to,
yeah, because he's an astrologer as well as a
and as well as many other things. And the whole time he's just trying to get rid of him so that he has time to get to this rendezvous during the prayers. But the time is passing and passing and passing. And that's where all the tension in the story is. And that's where you lose it in a summary form, because it's really, the tension in the story is absolutely there as you're reading it. And you're like, and the barber will shave part of his head. And that's part of the reason why he's stuck, is because he's got like half his head shaved. And then the barber tells some ridiculous story or says, oh, I have a party tonight and I forgot. I need to go get all the food for it. And our protagonist person is saying, you can have all the food in my house because I'm also going out tonight. And he's like, okay, that's fine, but can you show it to me first? You know? And it's things like that. It just drags on and on and on. Anyway, he finally thinks that he's rid himself of this barber, and he sneaks off, and he actually arrives at the house just moments before the judge comes back, the father, because he was supposed to have this whole, you know, the whole time they're all at prayers together, but he ends up arriving literally moments before because the barber has taken so much time cutting his hair. And he doesn't realize it at first, but the barber has actually followed him to this rendezvous point. So now he's hiding in the house because the judge can't know he's there. He's never even met up with the girl. He's just like hiding in the house. And meanwhile, some maid has done something wrong that the judge doesn't like. So he starts to beat the maid, and she starts crying out. And the barber outside thinks that he's beating the daughter. And then a male slave comes in to help the female servant that's being beaten, and he starts getting beaten for trying to help. And the barber outside thinks that this is the guy, you know, the guy that he's just shaved his head, that's being beaten and killed. And so he tears his clothes and he's wailing and he says, you've killed my master. And he goes back to the guy's house and he riles all of his own servants up and says, you know, they've killed your master and come on. And so they all are outside the judge's house, and the judge, and they're wailing and they're screaming, and he sends a servant out, and the servant says, there's like 10,000 people outside saying that you murdered this guy. And the judge comes out and he says, why would I murder this guy? I don't even know who you're talking about. And he says, I know what happened. Like, he came to see your daughter and you caught him in the act and you've killed him. And the judge is embarrassed by this and says, well, if you can find him, you can bring him out. So our guy, the main guy, he's jumped into a chest, but somehow the barber finds that chest and carries it out of the house, and he's screaming the whole time, I've saved you, I've saved you. Well, this guy is just so put out by this whole thing that he jumps out of the chest, and that's how he breaks his leg. And he ends up running into a weaver's stand in the market, and the weaver keeps the barber at bay while this guy calls a notary to him, and he signs off, like, he basically wants to act as though he is dead. He passes all of his inheritance off to his children, sell the house, sell everything. I am going to be wandering in the wilderness so that I'm never near this barber again. And that's what he's doing when he arrives at the party, is he's been wandering, and then lo and behold, he meets the barber at the party. So there you go. I might
it just, it occurs to me how structurally different this is from the Young Merchant story, even though both of them are about a guy heading to an assignation on a Friday afternoon when he's supposed to be at prayers.
Yeah.
But like, this is a totally different kind of story than that. This is a much funnier, you know, this is another joke story.
Yeah.
basically. But I mean, but the joke here is much different than the joke in The Hunchback. It's the range of genre in The Arabian Nights is pretty incredible.
Yeah. There's something about a story like this. So I found this phrase from Adam Roberts. I read his Substack, and he said something about making your teeth itch. And like when he said it, like I just knew exactly what he was talking about. And I don't know if you get that feeling too, but it's just like as I was reading this story, it's just like you hate the barber so much, but at the same time, the barber actually, in a way, is protecting this guy from sin, you know.
Like, right
so you shouldn't hate the barber, but you do. And so yeah, but I feel like I get that same sort of feeling, you know. The Looney Tunes cartoon, the One Froggy Evening. You know that one
with the frog that sings,
the frog that sings, but only
Coney Island Baby.
Yeah, but only for the guy, like never when he wants him to, but only for like only when they're alone. I get that same sort of like vibe from this story as that story. Like there's just something about it where it's just like it drives you nuts, you know.
do you know who Tom Arnold is, the actor Tom Arnold?
Yes. Yeah,
that's who I picture the barber as. I feel like if you were filming this, you could cast Tom Arnold as the barber and it would really get it across.
Yeah, there you go. So
like super annoying affability.
Yeah.
When we didn't even go over the stories of his six brothers.
No, yeah, the fun thing about the Arabian Nights is I really do like the structure, like where it's stories within stories within stories within stories. I think that's really cool. It's just that in this particular case, you're like four stories deep at this point, right? Like if, you know, there's the overall frame story, and then there's the Hunchback story, and then there's the Taylor story, and then the barber starts telling all these stories. And as much as I enjoy that structure, the barber himself is so annoying, and all those stories are so annoying that I didn't.
Right, he's not a character you want to spend 50 pages with.
Yeah, but it is a fun idea of structure of this character within the story now is going to start telling a story. It's a fun idea.
All right.
Everything secret will come to light. That's what I wrote in my notes for this one. Seems like
that's isn't that the name of one of the Grimm's stories? Everything.
Oh, is it? Maybe. That's fine.
I think it's something like that. It's the one about the guy who kills the Jewish man.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It's something. It's called something like that.
Yeah, could be. But that's kind of how this one feels. Like he's trying to do this secretive thing and. He doesn't even get a chance to do it, but it's still revealed and it's still destroyed. Right. It still destroys his life in the same way that it would have destroyed his life if he'd been caught, you know? So, or actually, yeah. You know, from the barber's point of view, he's actually saved his life because he would have been killed if he'd been caught. So,
but he has no appreciation for that or understand. He has not a whole lot more self knowledge than the barber does.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, I think we've got a shorter reading next month. If people are reading along with us, we're going to read through night 45. So that's only about 60 pages because of the way these things are broken up. Then we've got a real, Josh and I will make a decision because the next episode will either have to be 300 pages or it'll have to be one story that's still more than 150 pages.
Yeah.
But this next one will be short and fairly, you know, normal for the Arabian Nights instead of having this ultra long story.
Sounds good. Well, this has been fun, Michael.
As always. Hopefully we won't skip another month.
Yeah, that's...
But who knows? We don't get paid to do this.
That's right. our press liaison is Christian Filipic. We're on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. Please continue to this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, where you'll find abundance of old shows and some occasional new shows. Nathan Gilmore is still pressing on with the Christian Humanist profiles over there to keep you going. Also, don't forget Michael's new, and Michael, say the names of both the shows that you're on again.
So yeah, I'm on the most recent episode of Propaniacs, which is available on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And I've just started a new show called Symposium of Popular Songs, which you can access at frontporchrepublic.com.
Well, Michael and I know there are a great number of podcasts out there you could be spending your time on, so thank you for spending the time with us.